Hi, I'm Mordechai Torchiner with Beit Midrash Zichro Nedov. Our Beit Midrash, in tandem with Congregation Shari Shemayim here in Toronto, is presenting a Shavua Tone, a week of learning about the pandemic and various aspects, ethical, philosophical, and halachic. This video is associated with the first program in our Shavua Tone to be held Sunday evening, May 3rd, and our topic will be lockdowns. Are they worth it? I'd like to thank Shari Shemayim, as well as Rabbi Strauchler and Meital in the office for all their help in producing this Shavua Tone. So the way our Shavua Tone is going to work is this. Each evening, from Sunday through Thursday, we're going to offer a session on a different aspect of the COVID-19 pandemic. Evening sessions are generally held at 8:45 p.m., right after the shul finishes Mincha, Maariv, and Tehillim, except for the Wednesday evening class, which will be at 7:30 p.m. In advance of each sessions, we're going to provide materials hosted on our website and sent out in Shari Shemayim's email. On Friday at 6:45 p.m., right before Kabbalat Shabbat, Rabbi Sammy Bergman will deliver a drasha, Sfirat HaKovid, the count that must go on, and that will be the culmination of this Shavua Tone. You can find the flyer with the topics and times on our website at www.torontotorah.com/pandemic. For information about the Zoom sessions and to find out the Zoom address, please contact the Shari Shemayim office at coordinator@shamayim.org, and the link will be in the description below. So the topic for this session, the one for Sunday, May 3rd, is lockdowns, are they worth it? Stay-at-home policies come with multiple costs, physical, emotional, financial, social, and the question is, at what point do we say that the price is too high? Now, in this video and in the session, we're not going to answer this question. What I'd like to do in this video and in the source sheet, link in the description below, I intend to bring Torah sources which speak to this debate. The sources are not exhaustive, they're not dispositive, they're just meant to add background on how the Torah relates to the issue. Then in our Zoom session on Sunday evening, I intend to discuss who is supposed to make this decision. How are they supposed to make this decision about lockdowns and their value and whether they're worthwhile from the perspective of Jewish law? So let's get into it. I plan to begin by talking about the benefits of a lockdown, then to move into talking about the costs of a lockdown. So first of all, the benefits. We know what a lockdown, or you know, I keep using the term lockdown, isolation, and so on. You can come up with the, you know the terminology. But what is it supposed to accomplish? Well, it's supposed to prevent community transmission of the disease, right, of the virus which causes the disease. We keep those who are ill away from others, and we keep those who are healthy away from those who are ill. We don't bank on recognizing those who are ill because we know that people who are asymptomatic are still contagious. It's also not only about protecting people who are physically vulnerable to the illness. It's also about preventing harm in broader circles, because there's fallout. There's fallout. There's reduced availability of medical resources. If we're using them for those who are ill, we're not able to use them for other people. There's also non-fatal medical harm that may happen to people, even if they're not in a very vulnerable population. There's the personal loss when people lose a relative or even just have a relative hospitalized. That has a cost as well. Really, it extends far beyond, the harm extends far beyond the group of people who are immediately and dramatically vulnerable to the pandemic. So that's what we want to prevent. That cost is what we want to prevent via the lockdown. That's the benefit. Judaism has a long history of endorsing this kind of stay-at-home policy. On the source sheet, in the first source, I brought you a passage from the Gemara a couple of thousand years ago, Roman times. The Gemara in Bava Kamma, which says, and for all the sources, I'm going to read my English translation as opposed to the original Hebrew, but you can look at the source sheet to see the authentic original. Our sages taught, if there is a plague in the city, draw inward, go into your house. And they quote you a verse from Parshas Bo, from the passage when the Jews are in their homes on the night of Pesach, and they are told, do not leave the entrance of your homes until morning. The Talmud borrows that line and says, if there's a plague, stay indoors. It then goes on to say, and if there's hunger, then you should go out and find food. But the point is, stay indoors. You can move to more contemporary times. You move to the cholera epidemics in the 19th century. I brought you a passage from Rabbi Akiva Eiger, in which he spoke about limiting the size of groups that would pray in the synagogue to 15, and making sure that people will stay away from each other, that they'll be isolated, and using the police in order to do so. There's a lot more that you could bring on this. This is just a summary video. And the philosophy behind having the community restrict itself in this way, staying at home, acting in order to protect the vulnerable, that idea can be expressed in a couple of different ways. One approach, as expressed by Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg in source number 3, is that we view the community as a set of individuals. We know within Judaism that each individual has an obligation to look out for others. I have a mitzvah of v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. I have a mitzvah of looking after the property of other people, and so on. Well, if I have an obligation to look after the needs of others in all these other ways, certainly on a medical level I do, and you could bring many more proofs to that. Do not stand by while your brother's blood is shed. So Rabbi Waldenberg's philosophy, expressed in number 3, but also elsewhere in his writings, is to say the community is a set of individuals. Each individual has an obligation to look after others, so therefore, hey, stay at home. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it, Rabbi Yosef Shalom Elyashiv, he suggested that you can look at it not only as the community is a set of individuals and they each have a personal responsibility, there is a communal responsibility to look after the welfare of the community. I brought this in source number 4 from his son-in-law, Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein. Rabbi Zilberstein writes, "By law, we must save the greatest number of ill people." What he's talking about, I should preface, is a case in which someone has made a contribution, a large contribution, to a hospital, and the question is, where do we invest it? What do we use it for? And he says, "By law, we must save the greatest number of ill people, invest financially in emergency care and a NICU, as opposed to a transplant unit where you'll spend a large amount of money to save fewer people." But then he continues to say, one cannot close or fail to open a transplant unit because communal needs are also considered life-saving. This is a communal need. There has to be one. Why? Because if the transplant unit would be closed, it would cause low morale. People would refuse to live there. Rabbi Yashiv says, the community has to preserve its status as a community. You need to build a space in which people wish to live. And therefore, there's an obligation. And that translates here. Not only do I have an obligation to stay at home in order to protect other individuals, I have to stay at home because I want a community that people are going to want to live in and be able to live in. That's on the side of the benefits of a lockdown. Switch gears. We have practical questions about the value of a lockdown. Today, as I'm filming this, is Wednesday night, April 29th. Today was Yom HaAtzmaut, Chag Sameach. If you take a look at source number 5, you find a news story from today. CBC, people are getting COVID-19 by community transmission, but Ontario knows little about how. Despite 6 weeks of workplace closures, physical distancing, and stay-at-home messages, people are still contracting COVID-19 in Ontario communities, and public health officials don't have a firm handle on why or how it's happening. Roughly half of Ontario's new cases of the coronavirus are among residents and staff of long-term care homes, along with other frontline health workers. But for the remaining cases, the sources of infection are often unspecified, and as I heard it discussed in a news story on the radio this morning, there's a lot of concern, because if people are following the lockdown, why are we still getting large growth in new cases, greater growth than was expected after we've been in a lockdown for this period of time? So does it actually work is one question. And then on the other hand, is it truly necessary? And in source number 6, I brought you an article headlined, "Flat Out Incorrect, Scientists Debunk Saskatoon Biologists' Claim." And this is also from the CBC. An associate professor of biology in Saskatchewan has raised the ire of other scientists after he claimed that most people in the province had already contracted the novel coronavirus and recovered from it, rendering the lockdown unnecessary. He created a video in which he said the Saskatchewan Health Authority has demonstrated, quote, gross ineptness in its handling of the pandemic because it has been unwilling to conduct or approve antibody testing. Why are they not listening to alternate hypotheses and alternate theories?
Excuse me.
He goes on to say that he believes that we already have achieved herd immunity, or at least they have in Saskatoon, or Saskatchewan as a whole, perhaps, unclear from the article. And the article goes on to say experts consulted by CBC agree that if 60% to 70% of the population had COVID-19 antibodies, that should stop the virus from spreading as widely or as quickly. It's a concept known as herd immunity. I'm not going into the science of this right now, as well as the question of whether one who has already had it and has the antibodies is truly protected. That's its own discussion. The point is, as the article continues, that his claim is just wishful thinking. COVID-19 studies from around the world have shown no comparable rates of infection, meaning no one's at 60 to 70%, right? They're doing tests in New York, and they've discovered that, you know, they've got 20% in the epicenter of epicenters in North America. 60%, 70%, as the article puts it, is not an evidence-driven claim at all. But I'm not interested so much in the refutation. It's the question, is this really necessary? People are asking, what if I live in a community that's far-flung, that's remote? What if I live in a community that does not have the density of major cities? What if I could engage in this particular business, this particular whatever it is, without being exposed to others? Do you really need this dramatic step of a lockdown? And that becomes a stronger question when we look at the costs of a lockdown, and we're going to look at four areas: physical, economic, mental health, and family. So first of all, the physical health cost. I brought you source number 7 from a health update from yesterday, from April 28th. Citing a University Health Network report, Ontario's Health Minister, Christine Elliott, said today that 35 cardiac care patients may have died after heart surgeries were canceled to free up beds for an anticipated surge in COVID-19 patients. That's not something any of us want to hear, she said during the province's daily press briefing. I don't want to call it collateral damage because they are deaths and it is very concerning and sad to all of us, which is certainly true. Now, there she's actually talking about where they were freeing up beds on behalf of COVID-19 patients. But there's also the concern about all the surgeries that are being deferred in order to keep people at home, in order to keep people out of the hospital, and the potential harm that can come from that. Now, that's one view, right? There's a physical health cost to having the lockdown. So you're going to tell me that you're going to harm the people who are vulnerable, the people who can't have their surgeries, in order to be able to have this lockdown. However, flip side of that, if I take the view that the community is a supersized individual, so to speak, the community is of greater worth than individuals, then the larger the community, the more they matter. In other words, when we talk about triage in Judaism, we emphasize trying to save the maximum number of lives. That's not just in Judaism, that's in general bioethics. But it's certainly true within Judaism. We want to save as many people as possible. So if I have to choose, and this is a terrible choice to have to make, but if I have to choose the minority who are going to have their surgeries pushed off versus the great number of people who will be affected if you don't have a lockdown, I'm going to choose the larger number of people, right? If you take a look at source number 8, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, a contemporary not only doctor, pediatric neurologist, but also a leading authority on Jewish medical ethics, take a look at what he has to say here in his HaRefuah KaHalacha in source number 8. The community and the collective are not only a collection of individuals, but an independent entity of its own nature, with its own rules, and with the community's collective needs, sometimes even at the expense of the individual. And even though an individual is not nullified opposite the community, still the community must make a special calculation of its own in different circumstances. In other words, what Rabbi Dr. Steinberg is saying is that we look at this community and say, it's larger. the larger community of those in need is going to have greater weight than the smaller group. Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli made this point in source number 9 decades ago, talking about the fact that Jewish law authorizes the community to go to war against an enemy, not talking about where they're now defending against an imminent attack, but I'm talking about the ability of a community to engage in what Jewish law calls a discretionary war. How are you allowed to do that? You're exposing soldiers to risk. There's no question that you have to expect people are going to get hurt. That's an expectation when you go to war. How are you allowed to endanger your soldiers? And the answer seems to be that where it is for the benefit of the community as a whole, and this is what I brought you in source number 9, the benefit of the community as a whole may well override the smaller group within the community. So our first look is at the physical cost of a lockdown. And what we've seen is that there is a physical cost. There are people who will suffer because of this lockdown in a very tangible way. At the same time, you may have to do the math and say, well, on which side are more people in danger? Let's talk economic cost. We see the reports every day about the toll on businesses, the toll on jobs, the efforts governments are making to try to help them. You could make a halachic argument, and I think a strong one, that there are limits to what we do to the community financially, even in order to save lives. Key passage. Passage in the Talmud in Gittin, source number 10. Goes back to Roman times and Jews being taken captive and sold as slaves. And the question is, how far does a Jewish community have to go in order to ransom somebody who is being held as a slave? So the Mishnah begins. The Mishnah, the classic text, that's the core text of the Talmud, tells us, one may not redeem captives for more than their value. What they would get on the slave market is the general assumption. Not all rabbinic authorities agree that that's what's meant here by value, but I think it's a fair statement right now. One may not redeem captives for more than their value due to tikkun ha'olam. You want to repair the world. Ask the sages in the Gemara, commenting on this, what exactly does that mean, tikkun ha'olam, repair of the world? Does that refer to the burden on the community, or to a concern that the captors may capture and bring more captives? Why is it that you're putting a cap? Are you putting a cap because there's a great burden on the community if you're going to have to raise all this money? Or is it just because if you ransom this person, then they're going to go kidnap more people? Either way, we're trying to protect the community's finances, even though we know that by putting a cap, that means that there will be people who will not be rescued. They will not be ransomed. That seems to demonstrate that we don't make the community pay whatever sum for the sake of the lives of a minority. If you take a look at source number 11, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, ruled this way, as a matter of Jewish law, saying, if a community is pressed, and especially when the nations are in control of, quote, the enemies of Israel, which is a euphemism, then communal strain is included as a life-saving situation. He says, strain on the community itself is considered to be a life and death matter, and therefore the financial survival of the community under this strain is itself considered a matter of saving lives. That's one source that seems to say there's a cap on the financial strain we're going to put on the community in order even to save lives. Another possible source for this is from the Rambam, Maimonides. When he talks about the mitzvah of tzedakah, he does a very interesting thing. It's not his invention. He's basing himself on Talmudic sources, which can themselves be traced to biblical sources. But Maimonides, in sources 12 and 13, articulates the community responsibility for philanthropy, for tzedakah, versus the individual's responsibility. And what's of particular note is that in source number 12, where he speaks of this command for tzedakah, he says the obligation is to provide whatever the pauper's deficit is. Which, if you go back to the Talmud, you find out means you look at whatever this person's original living standard was. How did they grow up? How did they live before they became impoverished? Assuming that there was a life before they became impoverished. And you try to make up that standard, whatever that is. The Talmud is very extreme. It says if he used to ride in a chariot with runners before him, well, that's what you have to provide. Fill the deficit. Of course, if you can't provide that much, then again, you do triage. What can we do? Nonetheless, the point here is, when Maimonides speaks in source number 12, he says there's an obligation to provide whatever this person is lacking from what they're used to. Then you take a look at source number 13. And in source number 13, he talks about giving tzedakah as part of a community. Listen to this. One who dwells in a land for 30 days is compelled to give tzedakah to the weekly kupa collection with the citizenry. One who dwells there for 3 months is compelled to give to the daily tamchui, which was a food collection. So if you live there for a certain period of time, you have to give to the weekly food collection, or weekly funds for food. The second level one is the daily food, and that you do if you live there longer. One who dwells there for 6 months is compelled to give clothing for the local needy. One who dwells there for 9 months is compelled to give tzedakah for burial. Food, clothing, burial. Nothing about providing whatever they are lacking, which goes way beyond that. Why is that? So some suggest that in source number 12, where he talks about filling the deficit, if you look at the language carefully, he's talking about an individual's obligation. The burden for an individual giving tzedakah, try to fill this person's gap. Now, there is a cap on what an individual must spend. He gives up to 1/5 of his assets. Nonetheless, that's what you're expected to give as an individual. Community is not expected to do that. The community has a defined set of responsibilities. Food, clothing, burial, right? Hopefully food and clothing, not so much getting to burial. Nonetheless, this is the extent of the community's obligation. There is a cap protecting the community. So you can make the argument that in terms of a lockdown, there's a cap on what we're going to do in terms of a financial hit for the community. And yet, sources show that if there's an imminent danger to physical health, that will, in fact, come first. First of all, the source that I didn't bring this on the sheet because it only occurred to me right now, there's a Tosfos in Gittin, which mentions that the Talmud's cap on how much you spend to ransom people is only talking about where their lives are not in danger. However, if their lives are in danger, then there's no cap on what you spend. So that's, first of all, the position taken by Tosfos, medieval authorities writing on the Talmud. That's number one. But number two, take a look at source number 14, which deals with the question of spending on behalf of the community when people are going hungry. Look at this story. Once Rabbi Chama bar Chanina and Rabbi Hoshaya Rabbah were strolling among those synagogues of Lod. Rabbi Chama bar Chanina said to Rabbi Hoshaya, "How much money my ancestors sank here? They invested so much to build these synagogues." To which the reply was, "How many lives your ancestors sank here? Were there no people exhausting themselves in Torah?" Meaning you had people you could have supported with that money. You had paupers who were exhausting themselves in Torah. You could have supported them. And instead you built buildings. And so on. The Talmud continues in that vein. Similarly, there's a midrash in the Yalkut Shimoni. King David, we are told, set aside funds for the eventual construction of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple, and the midrash criticizes him for stockpiling funds for the temple instead of using them for the needy. Even though these are important communal needs, the synagogues, the study hall, and so on, the needy, social welfare, has to come first. If there's a threat to people's health, hunger, disease, that's going to have to come first. So now, under economic cost, not so clear. On the one hand, there's a cap on what the community has to spend. On the other hand, if you're talking about life and death needs, maybe that comes first, even against great financial expenditure. As I said, we're not answering these questions. We're just providing some sources. Third, the issue of mental health costs. The reports about the mental health costs in the Jewish world, in the general world, abound. You're taking people, putting them in their homes for extended period of time. Some people are on very severe lockdown orders. You can't go more than 100 meters from your home. Other people have a little bit more leeway. People who are living alone, people who are as families. This is really hard. And Jewish law places a major emphasis on looking out for the mental health, the emotional health of others. We have numerous prohibitions in the Torah against harming the emotional health of others. We have mitzvot about acting to support the mental health and emotional health of others. Jewish law says we override many great mitzvot in order to save people when their mental health is endangered. I brought you some examples of this in sources 15 and 16. Not going to go into it in great depth here, but in source number 15, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein approves contraception for a woman out of fear that she may enter into severe depression if she becomes pregnant. In source number 16, Rabbi Nassim Tzvi Friedman, a 20th century rabbi in Israel, talks about violating various laws, including Shabbos, on behalf of somebody who is irrational and maybe dealing with some kind of a psychotic episode. We take this very, very seriously in Jewish law. So what do you do when, again, calculating the impact on the mental health of the nation at large versus, sorry, the mental health of those who would be vulnerable? So I misstated that. The mental health of people who are vulnerable to that versus the physical survival of others. So here we have a passage in the Talmud, and I say right off the bat, it's not the same as what we're talking about, but I think, nonetheless, it may bear consideration. Take a look at source number 17, a Gemara in Nedarim. If a spring is owned by a certain town, there's a choice between their lives, in terms of their access to the spring, and the lives of others, right? You have people upstream and you have people downstream. The people upstream control the water supply. They say, we need the water for ourselves. Their lives come before those of others. They're not expected to give up their lives in order to provide water for others. Their own lives come first in their calculus. What about their animals versus water for the animals of others? Again, their animals come first. And if there's a choice between their laundry and that of others, their laundry comes before that of others. Straightforward. We do not obligate people to abandon their own needs in order to take care of equal needs for other people. If there's a choice between the lives of others and their laundry, then, say the sages, the lives of others precede their laundry. So the people who have access to the spring first are not entitled to take the water for their laundry, while other people are starving, while other people need drinking water. However, along comes the sage Rabbi Yossi, whose word carries a great deal of weight in the Talmud. And he says, no, their laundry precedes the lives of others. Ask the Talmud, what in the world are you talking about, Rabbi Yossi? You're telling me lack of laundry, right, is going to cause pain. Well, you know, lack of drinking water is also going to cause pain. Why are you not concerned about the drinking water for the people downstream? To which the answer is, Rabbi Yossi says, the need for laundry is actually much greater than you realize. And he quotes the sage Shmuel. Rabbi Yossi didn't quote Shmuel. Rabbi Yossi lived before Shmuel. But the Talmud, observing this debate, quotes Shmuel. Shmuel, a 3rd century sage, was also a doctor. So this piece of advice that he gives, it should be viewed in that context. He says, a dirty head leads to blindness. Dirty clothes lead to depression. A dirty body leads to boils and sores. I'm not clear on the blindness piece. The boils and sores, I think, are self-evident. Dirty clothes, he says, leads to depression. Keep in mind that based on sources from the Talmud and contemporaneous sources, we know that Jews living in that Roman era very often had very few changes of clothing, one or two possibly, and that's it. Number one. Number two, they dealt with vermin in their clothing. We have discussions in the Talmud and in Jewish law about picking vermin off of one's clothing on Shabbos and so forth. These are people who, like, you're talking about not having laundry. That doesn't mean they're missing bleach. It means that they're living in filth. That's what they're talking about. And he says that can actually lead to depression. So that's why Rabbi Yossi says their laundry comes first. Their mental health comes before the drinking water of others. So that's Rabbi Yossi's position. But we don't follow Rabbi Yossi. We follow the sages. And we say the drinking water of others still comes first. Rabbi Yossi Yehuda Unterman, the 2nd Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the state of Israel in the 1960s, rejected Rabbi Yossi's position. He said, as dire as that need is in terms of the laundry, nonetheless, you have some time before that becomes dangerous. Drinking water is immediate. That's one point. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein argued that actually even Rabbi Yossi didn't mean to put the mental health before the drinking water. He was talking about where there's a possibility for the people who are downstream who want drinking water to move. Yes, it's hazardous to move. Yes, it's financially devastating to move. Nonetheless, they have that possibility, and therefore it's not really a life and death calculus. Then he's willing to put the laundry first. But otherwise not. Again, this is not quite the same as what we're talking about in the lockdown case. I only bring it to show the calculation of, on the one hand, physical needs, and on the other hand, mental health needs, and that physical needs may well come first, and I think that that carries weight when we're dealing with the lockdown. Last item, the cost to families. The tensions between parents and children and between spouses are high when you're in isolation together for a long period of time. Existing fault lines are exacerbated, new ones are created. I brought you source number 19 out of China, a report on the rise in divorce rates after the end of the lockdown. And look, Jewish law certainly values families. I mean, that I think doesn't even require that I bring you a lot of sources on that one. Again, there's another side. There is another side. And the other side puts the physical health of the community over a family's health. In source number 20, brought you a passage in Megillah. This is regarding the story of Esther and Ahasuerus. Esther, who goes to Ahasuerus, right? Originally, she is taken by force. But then, when the Jews are in danger, she goes to Ahasuerus willingly and puts herself at his disposal. As the Talmud reads it, and this is a longer discussion, she was originally married to Mordechai. And by going to Ahasuerus willingly, that meant that she was ending her relationship with Mordechai. This is a bigger discussion in Jewish law, not for this video right now, but take a look at source number 20, the Talmud's line. Esther says, when she's going to go to Ahasuerus, as I am lost, I am lost. As I am lost from my father's house, she says to Mordechai, so I shall be lost from you. That's it. Why does she do it? To save the physical health of the Jews. And she gives up the family relationship. Now, there are numerous reasons why this is not the sole source that should be brought on this. I'm only trying to show an example of asking that question of family first or life of the community or physical survival first, and here physical survival is given primary importance. So again, to summarize, we've talked about the benefits of a lockdown as well as the questions about the value of a lockdown. Is it working? Is it necessary? And we identified four areas in which the lockdown has a major cost for the Jewish community or for individuals within the community. Physical health, people who are not able to access services, including health services that they need, economic cost to businesses, mental health cost, as well as cost in terms of relationships. And what we said is that there are sources in each case that can be brought, that can be marshaled, to say, nonetheless, physical health will come first, physical health of the community will come ahead of these other costs. Nonetheless, it's not dispositive. What I want to discuss when we have our Zoom session is, so who balances this? Who makes the decision? How is that decision made when you have to make that calculation? So I hope that you will join me on Sunday evening on Zoom, Sunday evening, May 3rd at 8:45 p.m. to continue this discussion. Thank you very much for watching.